So this is the fifth and final day of our five-day retreat on composting fear into fearlessness, healing the separate self. So before we jump into the matter at hand, let me just say a point of clarification. You may notice this morning that our ranks are a little thin. Some people had to leave after breakfast. That is a failure of communication and misunderstanding. It has always been my policy, both at Southern Dharma and in Florida, that retreat is something that everyone begins together, practices together, and ends together. It is a group endeavor. It is not something one drops in on or drops out of. It is very important, both for the benefit of the individual, so they can get the full, beginning, middle, and end. Books have introductions, first chapters, and then they have last chapters. As well as for the sense of community that we develop here. And again, I don't hold anybody responsible who has left because they were not told the difference. But usually, even with people with very well-meaning, have good reasons, you know. I mean, just we're having a retreat coming up in Florida now. There's a woman who really wants to come, but right in the middle of the retreat, her son is getting confirmed. Should a mother be at her son's confirmation? Of course. I mean, if that's, if she feels she needs to be there. But therefore, that means this is not the right time to go on retreat. Right? That's all. Be there for your son. So again, it is very important that we understand it. I'm only saying this to you, so in case anybody ever wants to come back on retreat with me again, don't think that this is normal, okay? It's just a misunderstanding with Southern Dharma this time. Having said that, we are in our final day. And as everyone who has been here knows over these past 5 days, in a certain sense, we've covered a lot of territory. Even though our primary focus has been on learning to deal with this emotional affliction that is often disturbing to crippling, even sometimes causes us to be willing to sacrifice our dear friends. Right, Emily? So we know that it is a significant affliction, or can be. And so even though that has been our focus, we really have looked a lot at various teachings, especially in impermanence, cause and effect, to get the big picture. Again, as I've said earlier, if we get the big picture, if we really get impermanence, not just as a concept, not as a good idea, not as, everything changes, that's right. But all these things that are going on in life, that's change. That's the way it is. And when you understand that, there is no fear. There is understanding. And when one also looks at, understands more deeply about the mind, as we've also talked about, but also practiced, what is this mind? What are thoughts? What are emotions? What really is the past thinking and future thinking? Really understands clearly the insubstantiability of all thought and the total irrationality of all future and past thinking, that it is, in a certain sense, can be meaningful in a certain way, but is ultimately delusional. Because we're talking about events that have no longer exist. We're talking about events that have not arrived yet. So they are just simply fabrications, imaginations of the mind. Again, sometimes they can be helpful to think about things in a certain way. One goes to a funeral, one recalls hopefully the good things about the person who has died. We remember. We get together for reunions. We get together for family events. We get together with old friends, and we may talk about old times. But hopefully we understand those are old times. In the same way, there is a certain degree of planning or thinking about the future that one has to do, but that is very different than worrying about the future. Worry is an add-on. Again, as we've talked for many people, anxiety and worry seems normal. It's not normal. It's an add-on. So again, we've also spent a lot of time, obviously, in this retreat, practicing meditation, mindfulness meditation, concentration, looking deeply, insight, to really bring together, to have an experiential way to not just have a conceptual understanding about the big picture and fears in the mind, but to really have a direct experience of it. So it becomes real. That means it becomes a realization. And then real healing and transformation is possible. So before we talk about the future, which is illusionary, but still, again, some degree of thinking in a constructive way about the future and how we want our future to be. In other words, that's often called aspiration and intention. It's actually central to Buddhism, right? But it's, again, it's about how do you develop an altruistic aspiration for your life, so your life has meaning. Aspiration is big, right? And then how do I intend on a day-to-day basis to realize my aspiration? Well, that now we're getting more into the world of intention, more consciously how we are intending our life to be, our interactions to be, etc., right? So that kind of future thinking can be helpful, right? Such as you're going on a trip and you're kind of, you know, planning your itinerary. That can be helpful. Sometimes you can't get the train tickets at the end, right? So there's a certain degree of planning, both in the practical way, but especially for our so-called spiritual life. I think that is a failure of many people in this Dharma game or this meditative game, is they really don't have a clear aspiration for themselves. You know, why am I doing this? And not just like, you know, the aspiration is what got me on the path 5 years ago. You know, have you been nurturing that aspiration daily, so that it's still very alive and central to your life, so you always know every day when you wake up what this day is about? For practitioner Dharma, this day is only about one thing. It's not getting my to-do list done. Okay? Which many people think is the purpose of life. You know, that's how disturbed we become. It's not about getting our to-do list back. But you know, done. And it's not really about all the things we do in our life and our work and our job and our family responsibilities. Those are all things that we need to take care of. But for a Dharma practitioner, today's only about one thing: practice. You know, living mindfully, living in the present moment. You know, in all my interactions, being open, loving, kind, compassionate, understanding, patient, generous. Is that clear? That's what my day is about. And whether I'm at home, or whether I'm on vacation, or whether I'm at work, or whether I'm in the family, or whether I'm out shopping, or whether I'm interacting with people I'm close with or strangers, I'm practicing. Is that clear? Why? Because my aspiration is always present to me, and it manifests day to day in clear intention. If you do not have that, and many people who say they practice Dharma don't have that, then they wonder why the day slips by. Right? They wonder why the weeks, the months, the years slip by, and they still seem to be in the same place. And unfortunately, there are many people who practice a spiritual path who are always recycling the same stuff. Okay? And that is clear because they don't understand the power of aspiration and the power of intention. And that, you know, I'm not just making that up. That is Buddhism. Right? Many people may know that one of the, I think I might have referred to it, that one of the classics of the Bodhisattva path in Mahayana Buddhism is called the Path of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. People familiar with that? Okay. If you're interested in the Bodhisattva path, pick it up. It's really about the whole path, okay? And it really focuses on what's called the six paramitas that go from generosity and patience right through meditation and wisdom. It's a very profound text. But you know what his first chapter is? Before he even gets into practice, people go, what's this about, right? Let's get into the practice. You know, I'm a big shot. Give me the big stuff. His first chapter is all about aspiration. It's all about compassion. It's all about why you're doing this. You know, it's all about intention. That's the first step. Before you even cross your legs, right? Before you even hear a talk on meditation, you know, why you're doing this. Is that clear? Why are you doing this? If you don't have that aspiration in anything in life, why am I doing this? Right? I mean, when I used to be a family counselor and see couples, you know, all kinds of, it's like, you know, all kinds of problems. It's like, well, what's your aspiration for your relationship? And they look at me like, you know, like, what am I talking about? I mean, like, what's your aspiration? How do you want to be in this thing? I mean, do you want to have a loving relationship with this other human being? You know, do you want to use it as a vehicle to develop kindness and patience? And, you know, I mean, and they look at you like, what are you talking about? Right? Because if you don't have that, what do you have? Ego, self, all the stuff we've always had. Right? That'll be always be the motivation. What's in it for me? Right? You know, most people are in relationships for one reason. What's that? To get their needs met. Well, no wonder people have problems in relationships, you know. Because unfortunately, there's another person in the relationship who also has needs that they want to meet. Right? You know what happens next? Conflict. That's just the way it is, isn't it? That's the way it is. So, I want to take this time, before we talk about future practice, as I said, we've covered a lot over these past 5 days. Anybody have any questions about the teachings they've received? Anybody have any questions about the practices we've done? Anybody not sure about, well, they kind of get the practices and the teachings, but how to apply them in your daily life? I mean, this is an opportunity before we break camp to talk about that. So, and I want to say something about the question you asked me last night, but go on. So that's equality. That's that thing that's said before the Dharma talk. May we be liberated from. And that is something, actually, I never heard until Thich Nhat Hanh slipped that in somewhere. but I think it's quite interesting. Because usually, again, I think we're all very conversant with superiority complex and inferiority. I mean, superiority complex is the ego that, what? It thinks it's better than everybody and wants to be better. Right, the inferiority complex is the opposite set. It's like I'm less than, I'm deficient. Don't notice me. Right, the arrogant person, I'm great. Everybody notice me. Right, okay. Now, in the realm of Buddhist psychology, superiority complex, inferiority complex are just kind of characteristics of the way a self has been conditioned, okay? So it's all about self. So from the point of view of Buddhist psychology, whether you think you have the greatest self that the world has ever seen, or if you think you have the worst self that the world has ever seen, you're kind of equal. You're both totally ensnared in the world of self. You don't get any points on one way. Even though functionally, probably would say, yeah, I really would much rather, be arrogant, an arrogant SOB, than to always feel miserable. But again, now, what, and again, I, you know, It's also saying, when it talks about the equality complex, is also that recognition that many cells don't want to recognize that we are different too. We, you know, I mean, we may be equal, all equal in the eyes of the law, right? That's a legal thing. But in truth, we are not all equal. Some of us are smarter than others. Some of us have better voices than others. Some of us are more athletic than others, right? You know what I'm saying? Some of us can paint better than others, right? Can you see? So that sense is like, I'm equal, right? Hey, you know. I should get a raise too. Right? Why did that person get a raise? I'm as good as them, right? Hey, how come everybody's paying attention to that person? I'm as good as them. Can you see? It's kind of not getting stuck in which is really kind of jealousy and envy, right? It's really understanding, yeah, people are. I mean, I got to hand it to you. You cook Indian food much better than I do, right? So like, hey, how come how come she cooks better food? You know what I'm saying? So it's that kind of envy, jealousy. What it's really saying with the equality, the inferiority, and the superiority, inferiority, and equality is that all the stances that the self takes to define itself, may I be liberated from all of them. Is that clear?
Equality is also another of ego's complex.
And yeah, just another way that ego kind of manifests itself, right? We want to be free of all of that. Yeah, I mean, we're quite happy to say, yeah, you know, you're a much better cook. Great. One, you know what I mean? We can compliment people. Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, they deserve that raise. Yeah. Maybe my time will come. Right? You know what I mean? The person deserved that promotion. Yeah, that, you know, yeah, I don't have to be the center of attention. It's actually, in Buddhism, it's the opposite. We're happy. It's called joy in the joy of others. You know, it's a third of the qualities of the four immeasurables, you know? Yeah, I'm happy that people are happy, right? I'm happy that everybody's complimenting the cook on her food. You know, it's myself doesn't have to get involved with that, does it?
I've heard some folks say, well, you are something new. You know, you're so much better and you're calling the chef.
Yeah, again, it's that jealousy, it's that envy, saying, oh, how wonderful that their yoga is so good. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it'd be nice. Yeah, it inspires me, is rather than jealousy, you see, which again, it causes an affliction of emotion. Other questions? Anything that has gone on in terms of teaching or practices in this retreat that is not clear? And most importantly, how to practice it going forward in your life? Yes.
I'm really curious about the other question, but you wanted to answer first.
Is she curious about it? She is. So I was asked about various meditations that you do, which involve kind of like trance states and lights and you know, various things, which again, in various meditational systems, are very much practiced, and credence is given to certain types of realizations within those systems. And even within the wide universe of Buddhism, there are traditions in Buddhism that are more what are called tantric, in which the use of mantra, the use of visualization, the use of the chakras and seed syllables and these kinds of things are cultivated. But you were asking me about in Buddhism, how does that relate? Basically, in the traditions that I've practiced in, which are the Zen traditions and what's called in Tibetan Buddhism the Great Perfection or Dzogchen traditions, it is not about any of that. It is about this. Okay? So even when you are having great visions, right? Even when you are voyaging to various types of astral planes or something, right? For Buddhists, the key question is, what is aware of that? See, all of that is arising in your awareness, right? You're aware. There's awareness of this experience. And we'd say, well, most people would say, well, what is aware of that? There's always seems to be this awareness, even of these incredible quote-unquote spiritual experience. In Buddhism, the key fundamental question is, what is that? That is the very ground of being. And it is that that ultimately, and most people don't get there, but everybody can get there because it is the basis of our mind. What is that? And traditionally in Buddhism, that is actually this kind of unnameable beyond words, but it is characterized by great openness, by great spaciousness, by luminosity, by clarity, right? And that also has this incredible capacity of knowing. It is the fundamental intelligence, not the intellectual intelligence, but the intelligence that knows things as they are. It is the realization of this that is the ultimate goal. And again, in your Hindu tradition, are you familiar with Ramana Maharshi? Sort of. If you look at his teachings and his life, that would probably be closest to what I'm talking about, or the Vedantic traditions in Advaita tradition. What? Yeah. So again, it's as you know, Buddhism developed out of the Vedic tradition. The Buddha, that's a tradition he grew up in. He obviously had his own realizations and his own teachings, but there is, as you know, many similarities because it was in the Vedic tradition that he developed, and also we know that his training, until he kind of went his own way, was with all the leading yogis of his time in northern India. So he certainly imbibed deeply those teachings. Yes.
So in composting fear, it has to do with cultivating your self-awareness that you can handle it, to nurture, you know, the good qualities and to keep the mind, imagination, churnings and stuff.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the question, say that just clearly again. So in composting fears,
in the compost,
if you're taking your fears and you're doing what?
You're seeing that you can handle it, that you have confidence.
Okay, so
nurturing yourself.
Right. So the first part of it is exactly, I mean, there has to be, you know, I mean, if we stick to we're going to do this one, we're going to run this one to death. But again, if you're going to undertake composting, you have to believe you have the capability of doing it. Right. So, yeah. So there has to be some level of confidence, not just in working with your fears, but in undertaking a spiritual path or doing everything. I mean, as you know, or many of you know, in the five essential afflictions promulgated in Buddhism, you know what the fifth is? You know, first is things like, you know, aversion and, you know, desire, attraction, aversion, hatred, confusion, you know, all those things. But you know what the fifth one is? Doubt. Interesting, but that is considered one of the most afflictive emotions that somebody on this path could have, to either doubt, two doubts. One doubt is your own capacity to come to be free and come to realization, to doubt that. And the second doubt is to doubt that you have an enlightened Buddha nature. That is the, you know, no matter how screwed up you are, that screwed upness is all manifesting in this pure from the very beginning mind. Okay, it is. I mean, it is like saying, even though you've been given this, you know, let's just keep the composting going, right? Anybody know what compost tea is? Gardeners love it. Anybody know what compost tea is? What's compost tea? What?
The drip.
The drip, right. And you're right. It's the stuff that drips from your compost that gardeners like to collect, but they don't drink it. It's not that kind of tea. It's tea for they put it on their plants. It's very rich. Now, if you know about water purification, right, you could take that compost tea and you could make it drinkable water, couldn't you? Right? Do you know what I'm saying? Because if you didn't know that even foul water is still water, right? And the essential purity of that water is still present in the water. And if you just took that dirty, foul water through a process of purification, you will have drinkable water. Are you with me? In the same way, this mind that appears to you as filled with defilements and neuroses and afflictions and stupidities, right? This same mind, put through the process of purification, this is Dharma practice, right? The essential purity of your mind can be revealed. Is that clear? And you have to have faith in that. You know, as you know, Buddhism, as we teach it, is not kind of theological, right? It is not a God-based belief in a supreme deity type of religion. Okay, is that clear? Right? We could say it is not a faith-based spiritual practice. Okay. But having said that, there are a couple of things that if you're going to be successful at this, you have to have kind of confidence. I mean, in Buddhism, actually, and again, I don't know about Hinduism, but the word is not faith. It's often translated as faith. It really means confidence or trust, which is, just another variation on faith. I mean, but one has to have confidence or trust, right, in ones that one has the capacity, even if one doesn't believe it, that one has the capacity, to be free. And two, even though that has not been one experience, that they experience their pure enlightened mind, right? But that when the Buddha and the teachers say it's there, you trust. You see, so there are certain things that we don't know yet. Right, that we have to trust. Is that clear? And for people, and it seems to be a lot of people in this culture, they have big issues with what? What's a big issue?
Trust.
I mean, that's like a big one in our society. Everybody, half the people in the world have trust issues. And for good reasons, obviously. I'm not, I'm just saying, it's just interesting because here on one hand I'm saying it's really essential to make progress on this path to have trust and confidence. Right? And yet many people having trust and confidence is difficult. Okay. Now, well, you've been saying it here, right? You every in your morning in the morning service every day we've been saying what? The three refuges, right? Everybody been saying them, whether you believe them or not? Yeah. So we've all been saying the three refuges, and actually up till this morning, we were reciting something called trust in mind. Sound familiar? Right. But let's take the three refuges, right? 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 You know, you're lost in the woods, right? You're lost in the woods, right? You're really lost. You don't have a map. Somehow you got totally turned around. You've gone up this way. You've gone up that way. You've turned around 25 times. And what happens? You can't find your way out. Okay? You're lost. Right? You're really lost. You can't find your way out. And you've tried many things, right? On your own. Now, along comes somebody walking through the woods. You tell them, I'm lost. They say to you, Well, it's a good thing we met. I know the way out. Right? You've got a, you're at a choice point in your life, aren't you? What are you going to do? You see? What are you going to do? What? You see, I mean, it, you know, you may not know this person perfectly well, right? But they're telling you they know the way out. You kind of check them out a little bit. They seem sane. You know, you ask them maybe, well, how do you know your way out? And they tell you, well, I've, you know, I know these woods well, right? You know. What are you going to do? You know, well, I mean, you're at a choice, right? You can either stay, nope, I'm going to find my way out. All right. Okay. If you want to stumble around in the woods for another 10, 20 years, that's fine. But there's somebody who knows the way out, and all you got to do is follow him. It doesn't mean, you know, that there may not be some, you know, rough walking, right? You know what I mean? But at least you know that it's going to where you want to go. Is that clear? That's what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I mean, it just, you know, it means, you know, in this world, left to my own devices, I have not figured out, I have not been able to put a stop to my own suffering, my own afflictions, my own out-of-control mind. I have not been able to transform my conditioning, right? And I'm, you know, I've tried this, I've tried that, and I'm still stumbling around. Mm-hmm. So along comes, you know, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, right? 2,600 years old. Dealing with the same stuff that we're dealing with, right? The only difference is what? It says, there's a, you know, there's a path to the cessation of suffering. It's a tried and true path. People have been walking it for 2,600 years. Indians have been walking it. Nepalis have been walking it. Chinese have been walking it. Southeast Asians have been walking it. Japanese have been walking it. Koreans have been walking it, right? Mongolians have been walking it. Taiwanese and even Americans can walk it, right? You know, and it works. I mean, you know, lifetime, you know, generation after generation, we don't just have the teachings of the Buddha, we have the teachings and the practices of all the masters right up to our present day, all saying the same thing, right? This is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. Is that clear? So it's really up to us, isn't it, to recognize this is a valid path. Right? This is not just this guy Fred showing up at Southern Dharma, you know, with his Dharma, saying, follow me. You know, this is somebody who's coming as a representative of a tradition that's 2,600 years old, right? And this is something that he has learned from his teachers. Who did they learn it from? Their teachers. Who did they learn it from, right? This is an unbroken tradition that goes back to the Buddha, right? And the teachers are not teachers because they went to school and studied in the Zen and the Dzogchen tradition, hopefully. These are the teachers are people who have some degree of realization of the teachings and are able to live it. They're manifesting it. It's not just acting. Even though we know there are many people out there who are good actors. So beware of those people. Okay? But, you know, you check it out. Good lineage, good tradition, good experience. You know, am I going to just stumble around on my own, or am I going to find a tried and true path, practical, it works? At that point, you can what? Yeah, and you can relax. Right, Emily? I mean, you know, you've been lost in the woods. How you've been just scared and anxious and sad, and you know, like, and all of a sudden, can you imagine? So all of a sudden, somebody comes along and goes, oh, yeah, follow me. I know the way out. How would Emily, what would happen to all her fears and anxieties? Immediately they would what? What?
Disappear.
disappear. Oh, what a relief, you know? So the experience of encountering the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the teachings, the teacher, should be like that. Right? Oh. Right? There is a way out. And all I got to do is follow it. Now, this is another problem with Americans. See, traditionally, Asians, and I realize we have a representative of the Asian culture here, come from societies that are traditionally very what? Hierarchical, right? Right? In lots of different ways. So in those societies, people are very, very, show great respect to authority, to teachers, to elders. I mean, it is so traditionally, people in Asia, again, not everybody, you know, when they go to their teacher and the teacher says, do this and this and this, what do? They do it. You know, it's like the same way they listen to their mummy and daddies traditionally. You know, they do it. Okay? Or the village elders or their grandparents, I mean, or their teachers, right? They do it. I mean, it sounds crazy to us, but that's the way people do it, you know. Children respect their teachers at school. They even maybe bow to them, right? I mean, stand up when they come in. I mean, in India, as you know, I don't know about still today, somebody you respect comes into the room. What do? But you also touch their feet, right? If you really respect them, you get down, you touch their feet. Right, yeah. I mean, it's a... So following instructions is much easier in those cultures traditionally. And, you know, unfortunately, they're in the process of becoming like us. Wait till they see what they have in store. Is that clear? So we not only have trust issues, we also have authority issues, right? Can you see what we're up against here? You know, so, you know, somebody gives us instructions and we go, well, I like that one. I think I'll follow that one. But those two, I don't like those, or those don't really meet my needs, or, you know what I mean? Or, well, I think I'll do it this way, you know. That's another reason that so many people do not make much progress in the Dharma, which means make progress in actually freeing themselves from their afflictions, right? Because they don't trust the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, and then they do not, you know, they don't follow the prescription, okay? Let's put it that way, right? Go to the doctor gives them the diagnosis, assessment, tells them do this, this, and this. They don't do it. They know better, right? Yeah, look at it, or they take it now and then. Yeah, or they do it now and then, you know. You know, when things get bad, then they'll, you know, do it as soon as they feel a little better. Yeah, who needs to do it? A lot of people practice Dharma that way, right? Things are getting a little rough. Got to get back to the cushion. Right? We've got to get good. Better go on retreat. Boy, do I need a retreat. Got to get back on, you know. And a couple of months later, things are better. You know, again, there's no consistency. Is that clear? So, yes.
So I've heard the difference between small doubt and big doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These are
Zen terms. Go on.
Part of what drew me and kept me following this path.
Mm-hmm.
That I heard the Buddha said, don't just blindly accept everything I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Investigate. Try it for yourself. And that to me seemed very different than the blind faith Christian tradition grew up in.
Right.
And so that seems to be a little different than what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you asked me that question. So should we clarify it? That's a good question. So Carrie's saying, hold on a second, Fred. Didn't the Buddha say, right, that don't just take what I say just because I say it on faith or because you love me or respect me? Test it. through your own experience, your own logic. Yes, the Buddha said that. And yes, I would say that. So I would say to Carrie, when you're lost in the woods, and you, all of a sudden somebody's coming down the trail kind of babbling to themselves, they're kind of slovenly, they're babbling, you talk to them a little bit and they seem a little confused, and then they say, follow me, I would maybe, you know, check it out a bit, okay? Check them out. Check her out, right? In Buddhism, it is said, and there are very clear teachings on what to look for in a teacher, okay? Right. So don't just follow a teacher or listen to a teaching because they tell you they're a teacher, right? Or because they went to this retreat or that workshop, or you know what I'm saying? Check them out, right? Check them out. See if there's an authenticity, right? Yeah. But at a certain point, you see, this is the problem. That what the Buddha said to his disciples was, yeah, don't just take it on faith. Check it out through your own experience. But when you have checked it out in your experience, he said, practice it. Okay? If you just stay in always checking it out, you're never going to get to the realization that comes from practice. So there's a certain point where you're checking out, you know, people check things out these days, right? They, you know, they go to this center, they go to that center, they go to this teacher, they go to that teacher. That's okay in the beginning. Check it out, right? So when you make your decision, you know, you're making it wisely and it feels right. But once you've, you know, it's like, what's it like? It's like dating. All right. When you're dating, what are you doing? You're checking it out. But if you're looking for, you know, a monogamous relationship, at a certain point, you have to what? Sorry, you have to what? Commit. Right? You got to, you know, it's, you know, you're no longer dating. Is that clear? You know, so many people in their spiritual life do this because there's just so much available. Right? I mean, you know, I mean, I live in Tampa, which is like Siberia for Dharma, and there are probably 10 Dharma, you know, little Dharma groups, right? And people can go from one to the other, one to the other. And they go to Hindu groups, Sufi groups, you know what I mean? Or if you want to go out of town, you can just go anywhere. Right? So it's, you can just keep looking forever. One of my first teachers said to me, you know, in Zen, we are not seekers, we are finders. Interesting. We are not seekers, we are finders. You know, you meet people, you know, I've met people over the years who define themselves as what? Spiritual seekers. You ever hear that word? I'm a spiritual seeker. Well, that's okay for the first year or two. But my question would be, don't you want to be a finder? You know, who wants to be a seeker your whole life? This is about realization. Is that clear? So, I mean, did that answer your question? So it's not taking it blindly, but at a certain point, you've checked it out that you have confidence. Confidence in the teacher, confidence in the path. You meet people, it seems to have worked for them. You read, you know, the accounts of the teachers and masters, seems to be fairly reliable, you know? You've done some practice on your own, seems to be making a little bit of a change. You go, I can trust this. I can have confidence. I don't need to keep doubting. Right. Is that clear? Yes.
Your
just talk a little louder. That's kind of raining.
I've come to your group for whatever you call it. For a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be somebody who likes to read because I take the information better than if I just hear it.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how profound it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering where to even start to
Yeah, so the question is.
What was your
question? Yeah, so the question is, you know, a lot of our learning comes from reading, right? So, you know, what are good books to read about Buddhism? Well, obviously, again, See, in the old days, it was easy. They didn't have bookstores, right? So the... Can you hear me? Yeah, it's raining. How's, is that any better? So, what?
Louder for a second.
Louder for a second. I don't know what to do. Speak as loudly as I can is the answer. Okay, can you hear me now? Yeah, maybe it'll stop raining. So, again, there are many, as I said, in the old days there weren't bookstores, and so usually you got your reading material from your teacher. Right, because books were printed on woodblock and everything. It was a much simpler time, and there weren't that many books. I mean, if you were a Hindu, you read the Bhagavad Gita. It wasn't like there were 1,000 books. It was so much. But nowadays, again, endlessly, Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh says anything. A month later, it's in a book. it's that way these days. So. Again, if you're beginning, I would start, with the beginning, sort of what we talked about earlier, basic books about Buddhist teaching, impermanence, law of cause and effect, the suffering, dukkha, the suffering, non-self, bodhicitta, aspiration, compassion, basic books about mindfulness, living in the present moment, the four anapanasati, mindfulness of the body and the breath. So you set out with the basic teachings of Buddhism and not just read it only intellectually, but, what I always say to people is when you, Dharma books are, you don't read them like a work of fiction. How do we read our normal books? We just keep turning the page, right? But a Dharma book, especially a good one, is has meaning, which means we should, like the Buddha said, stop. We should read a paragraph. Stop. What's being said here? Do I really understand it? And then if I understand it, what is its meaning for my life, the way I conduct my life? You see what I'm saying? So we really begin to see... both intellectual understanding, application, and then if it does have applications for my life, is there something that I need to change or modify in my life or the way I view things, because I can see that these teachings and these practices that I'm reading about have real relevance to my life, and I need to and if they make sense to me, I need to begin to make some changes in my life. Okay, so then it becomes practice. And again, in terms of Buddhism, there are lots of books, one about basic Buddhist teaching, books about basic mindfulness in everyday life, and then you can go deeper.
I write my notes in there when I read.
Yeah.
And a year or two later,
right. Yeah. So again, that's a good point, which is oftentimes because they're just, the book companies, everybody has a right to earn a living, but, you keep putting out titles, right? And people keep buying them. They're, more or less, they're all saying the same thing, aren't they? This one says it this way, and that one says it a little differently that way, it's just endless regurgitation. So, find a good book. Find a few good books that say it all and practice. The important thing is that our reading take us to the realm of practice. Okay? Yes.
Let me just add that on the Florida Community of Mindfulness website, one of the main sections is teachings. And in teachings, Fred's actually laid out the developmental path of practice. That's mindfulness, dharma, and wisdom. And on the website, in each one of those three paths, there are recommended readings, and there are also dharma talks that he's given that link right into that, and there are practices. So I think that's really
So Angie's just reminding us, and she's the webmaster, that on the Florida Community of Mindfulness, I'm just saying this for the recording here, on the Florida Community Mindfulness website, there is a whole, on the section of teachings, there's a whole developmental path that has teachings and readings and talks that kind of take one through from basic mindfulness through Dharma, through wisdom. Good. Other questions about any of the TS, yes, Carol?
Can
you say a few words about what
means in the chanting service in the Heart Syndrome? It says that Papa Nikita was moving in the course of perfect understanding.
You want
to know what? I wonder what that means, because I say those words in a book.
Yeah, so.
What is perfect understanding?
What is perfect understanding? Well, that is Prajnaparamita, right? The heart, right? This, the Heart Sutra is the heart of perfect wisdom, right? Right? So that sutra, and again, understand that the Prajnaparamita literature is quite large. There are several Prajnaparamita sutras. The longest one is in 100,000 verses. Then there are 20,000, 10,000, 5,000. Right? The Diamond Sutra is in the Prajnaparamita in the literature. The Heart Sutra is the shortest, right? As you might have noticed. And it is said that it contains the heart, the pith of the whole Prajnaparamita. It's all most condensed. Okay? Now, Prajna is a Sanskrit word that refers to wisdom. Okay? But it is not the wisdom of the intellect. It is the wisdom that comes from directly perceiving the truth about how things are. Okay? It is that wisdom. The wisdom that knows the fundamental nature of reality and how things truly are. Okay? So when it says Avalokiteshvara was coursing, I mean, that's
moving.
Sometimes it's coursing. It says that is the river, that is the mind that Avalokiteshvara is in. And all the thoughts and actions and speech of Avalokiteshvara is arising from that. That lets us know that this is not just Avalokiteshvara kind of thinking about highest wisdom, sharing what he has been thinking or reading or contemplating. This is coming from the realization and the direct experience of that which is called Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom. But not again as a thing, but as a direct experience. It lets us know this is authentic. This is really the way things are. So one would expect that everything that is then spoken in the sutra is, quote unquote, the truth. You know, not biblical truth, the truth of revelation. It is the truth of the direct experience of how things are. So it is to be trusted. Yes.
What are the 10 directions?
Oh, up, down, back, forth, right, left, zenith, nadir. You know, it's like everywhere. So, that's sort of, in Buddhism, they say these things. It's with different times. You know, we just say everywhere. They say the 10 directions. Everywhere. There is no place where this is not true. Okay. Yes, John.
For beginners, would you recommend the heart of the Buddhist teachings?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's by Thich Nhat Hanh. That's an excellent book on that really goes through the threes and the twos and the fours and the fives and the eights and the tens. I mean, it basically, and it's actually, if my recollection actually goes that way, he begins with the early numbers and keeps working up. So, yeah, the Heart of the Buddha's teaching is good. I certainly recommend that one in our community. There's a Tibetan teacher called Pacho Rinpoche, Words of My Perfect Teacher. The first section, just good basic Buddhism in terms of impermanence and things like that, practices. Yeah. Yeah, again, those are, you know, I mean, that's all good. I like more original sources for some strange reason. It doesn't mean that there aren't many wonderful modern-day American teachers writing about Buddhism and putting it in a modern context. But again, you have to remember you're getting somebody's flavor. You know, a modern-day person's understanding. So, like, even Thich Nhat Hanh, who everybody loves, we're basically getting his distillation, right, of Buddha's teachings, okay? Now, when he was coming up, he was reading the original sources, okay? Pema Chodron was coming up, was reading the original sources, okay? Jack Kornfield, the whole crew, they began reading the original sources. Okay, they've distilled it, and now they're kind of putting it out there in very understandable ways for Westerners, which is wonderful. I mean, I'm just saying my own personal, I like the original sources. You know, make it so you can make up your own mind. And then, see, in Buddhism, there is like the original sources, and then there's a whole body of literature of commentaries. And you find commentaries going back, you know, just a couple hundred years after the Buddha, they were already commenting on his teachings. And the commentaries were, you know, are often quite good because they elucidate, they explain, they're commenting on these original teachings, so they help us understand them. But I think it's often good for us to kind of encounter these traditional teachings to see what we make of them. And then you can read a commentary and go, well, you know, you read Pema Chodron, that's interesting, her take on it. Right, or this one's take on it, or, you know. Because again, Thich Nhat Hanh, who I love and is a great teacher of mine, he's Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, he's got his own slant on things. You know? And there are lots of things where he's explaining Buddhism where he's really talking about his own understanding and his own way of teaching and perceiving. And that just, which is wonderful. But, you know, if we don't have reading a couple, we'll think, oh, this is the only way of understanding this. This is the only way of practicing, which is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, obviously, to read and follow the teachings of a great master is certainly good. But I think it's also in line of what you're saying. It's good to kind of, you know, look at how different teachers have looked at the same teachings and how they might express their understanding of their practice. Again, it really depends on you. I mean, I've always had a deep interest in Buddhism. You know, I mean, I like reading sutras. I like reading original sources. I mean, that's always been an interest of mine. You know, it doesn't mean you have to read it all, right? I mean, the Buddha didn't read anything. Right? He didn't read one book on Buddhism. I mean, kind of amazing that people listen to him, right? He didn't have a PhD in religious studies, you know, I mean, and yet, right, so he just mined his own inherent wisdom of his own mind, the same thing that Avalokiteshvara did, okay? So, I mean, that ultimately is the truth. And the Buddha, he discovered the truths of impermanence and sickness, old age and death, and all the things we talk about. How? By observing. He observed life within himself, around him. So again, that's why we say that all the truths of Buddhism are not truths in an ecclesiastical sense. They're not given down from God or from on high. They're truths that come out of the living experience of human beings. So that's why they should all make sense to us. That's why the Buddha's teachings is so practical and logical, because he discovered them in life. Right? He didn't discover them up on the mountain. Is that clear? So again, it doesn't mean that, again, if we can look with the same kind of objectivity and clarity at life, we will see all the truths. Yes?
You talk a lot about Shantideva. Mm-hmm. I'm curious is the Sahastra teacher, and there's a number of translations. Do you recommend one?
So Shantideva, we're talking 8th century India, so he's not modern. But his book, The Path of the Bodhisattva, is, I would consider it in world literature, religious literature, one of the great, in other words, most religions have a couple of great texts. Shantideva's text is the great text on the Bodhisattva path from the 8th century. And there is a very good translation by the Padmakara group, Padmakara. There are a number of translations, but there really is a good one by the Padmakara group. It's published by either Wisdom Press or Shambhala or one of them.
I believe that.
Shambhala?
It's
on the website. Yeah. And it's, it is not light reading, but it's wonderful. And it's actually a poem. He wrote it all in verse. That's why the translation, to get a good translation, it's one thing to translate words, that are kind of narratives. But when you're translating a poem, that's also a profound poem, it takes a lot of skill. So this is a very good translation. It's called The Way of the Bodhisattva, the Bodhicaryavatara, by Shantideva. Yes.
And where does the mind training verses come from?
Oh, versus trust in the mind? Yeah, that actually comes. Ken, you didn't tell them.
No, I didn't.
The third Zen patriarch. It comes from China. So it's again, in terms of Zen, that lineage, trust in mind, versus, sometimes it's been called translated verses on the faith mind. Again, many translations of it. This is the third Zen patriarch. Okay. Number one was who? Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, did everybody know this? So Bodhidharma was Indian. He's the one who came from India, Bodhidharma. Suppose he came from southern India, because he came by boat to southern China. Bodhidharma is, Buddhism had already been for a number of centuries in China. So Buddhism, but he brought the Zen, the teachings that pointed directly to the mind. And really put the emphasis on meditation, as Zen continues to do. So he's the one who is considered to be the founder. He had his disciple, second Zen patriarch, and then the third one was the man who wrote verses on the faith or trust in mind. Okay? Is that your question? Good.
And then I was fine, being away, not too soft. Just
trust.
That was my experience this morning.
Good. Any other questions before we wrap this thing up?
Yeah, I have one more question on that, and if you want to discuss. Your spiritual journey from inception.
Well, I appreciate that, but we really don't have time for that now. So I appreciate your interest. She asked about my spiritual journey from beginning till end. That's just a story. But thank you for asking. So we're going to probably stop in a few minutes and then take a little break and then have our closing circle. Buddha Dharma Sangha. Okay? Now again, when anybody here applied to come to this retreat, nobody asked you whether you were a Buddhist. Nobody asked you whether you meditate regularly. Nobody asked you about any of that. Did you? Right? Anybody could come. So I have no, some of you I do know. But, you could be a Buddhist, a non-Buddhist, an anti-Buddhist. and here we are. The important thing going forward is if what you experienced here you have found meaningful. The teachings and, but most importantly, the practices, meaningful. And that the desire to be free of suffering and the desire to really experience wholeness of body and mind, the desire to really have a mind that experiences primarily positive emotions, if that is your aspiration, then you have to make some changes in your life. Okay, I mean, there's no other way around it. And one of the things that you need to do is to make sure that on a daily basis you are cultivating meditation and some degree of study, that you're keeping it alive, okay? Because everybody here, remember all that karma, all that conditioning, all that stuff we've been working on for decades? That's our default, okay? Remember I said that's a stream of cause and effect that is arising in our awareness moment to moment. You are trying to introduce something new to give your life a different direction. I'm not talking about you're going to, divorce your husband and get a new job and move, somewhere. I'm not talking external. I'm talking internal. A new direction. Everything outside can stay the same or not. But if you want to do that, that new direction has to be nurtured by aspiration and intention and clarity day by day. If you do not do that, and I'm sure many people in this room can attest to that, if you do not do that, the kind of insights or gains or aspiration or enthusiasm that you may be having right now will dissipate. Right? And a few days from now, a few weeks from now, it'll be as if you've never been here. Is that clear? So if this is something that is meaningful for you in your life, if it's not, go your way and prosper. But if this is meaningful for you, you have to find ways to nurture this on a daily basis, okay? Through practice, through daily practice, through some degree of study. And I would also recommend that if you are serious, that you find yourself a community of to practice with, Don't do it alone. It's good to have fellow travelers on the path with us, right, for guidance and support. And also, if you have the ability, to find yourself a teacher, right? Now, I do not call the big guys like Thich Nhat Hanh, Dalai Lama. Many people say, oh, Thich Nhat Hanh's my teacher, right? You meet people like that. Thich Nhat Hanh's my teacher. Dalai Lama's my teacher. My response is, oh, you know him personally. I mean, you go to him, he knows your practice, he tells you how to practice, he gives you feedback on your practice. I mean, and people say, well, actually, the truth is, I've never ever talked to him. Well, that means you've been to lectures by him. That's one thing. But to me, traditionally in the Zen tradition, teacher-student is an interaction, right? Teacher's guiding us. I mean, how else are we going to learn? How else do we know whether we're practicing correctly if we don't have teachers? Is that clear? I mean, there's nothing else in life where if you're learning something, right? If you're learning the piano, you could teach yourself. It may sound terrible. You still may enjoy it. Get a personal enjoyment. But it's good to have a teacher. Give a little feedback. Show us how to do it. Makes things a lot easier, quicker. Okay? Is that true? Any skill, any profession, you want to be a car mechanic, find yourself somebody to teach you how to, right? Doesn't matter what it is. Especially in this realm where self-delusion and subjectivity is so rampant, it is very hard to have clarity about oneself. Okay? Very difficult. That is why we need mirrors. Somebody who can see us clearly and somebody who can guide and support us along the path. Is that clear? So please, wherever you are, see if you can find yourself a teacher, a living teacher. I mean, if you can't find one, then obviously we do our best. But especially if you want to go deep into this, you know, you need a teacher. Okay? Somebody who knows you, who can guide you, who knows who you are. Okay? That's important. So that's that. Anything else? I think it's all been said. So it's 5 to 11. It's still raining out. It's been a very wet retreat for September. I mean, I did a 7-day retreat up here in June. I think it rained every day. And they told me that was unusual. But they,
it's you, Fred.
Right. But they said, but September is usually there's no rain. Very, very little rain in North Carolina. Yeah, so here we are. So anyhow.